your fault. Maybe it's not mine. I chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to play out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, be no doubt when you see you are. Grass makes heaven the middle of it. Grass makes heaven the middle. We are. Grass makes heaven the middle of it. Right on schedule.
The secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler, and we've got quite a program this week. We're going to be looking at quite a few interesting items. The first clip that I'm going to play is from Bonnie Faulkner's Guns and Butter. She had a program out on the West Coast in the Berkeley area, and she's interviewing Michael Hoffman, and we're just going to play a clip of it, but the title of the program was The Alchemical Processing of Humanity Through Public Psychodrama. And take special note of this freeze and thaw type of dynamic, because maybe that Time magazine article that was released just recently is part of that thaw. But anyway, listen to this very carefully and see what you think.
This is Guns and Butter.
Freemasonry, it gets its hold in America because it was able to grab onto the American Revolution and say, we are the antidote to these terrible religious wars. But what they were really doing is they were institutionalizing this rule by a cryptocracy, rule by the secrets keepers. They were undermining the courts. They were suborning jurors. And so people who were not Freemasons were at a disadvantage.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, Michael Hoffman. Today's show, The Alchemical Processing of Humanity Through Public Psychodrama. Michael Hoffman is a New York native and former reporter for the New York Bureau of the Associated Press. He studied under Fayez Abu-Jabir at the State University of New York at Oswego. He is the author of 9 books. His most recent is The Occult Renaissance Church of Rome. Today we discuss his book, Secret Societies and Psychological Warfare, published in April 2001, that focuses on the revelation of the method, or the doctrine of making manifest all that is hidden, the occult cryptocracy, Freemasonry, synchronicity, and advanced mind control. Michael Hoffman, welcome.
Thank you, Bonnie. It's good to be here.
I've just read your incredible book, Secret Societies and Psychological Warfare. In the chapter, Episodic Revelation and the Lone Nut Syndrome, is an excerpt from your book that I first read in another book that strongly resonated with me. You write, quote, "The following is a statement which comes from within the British intelligence wing of the cryptocracy. Quote, this demonstrates one of our simpler methods. Realizing that our activities will sooner or later come to light, we structure our activities so that as conspiracy researchers unravel them, they will release information into the public consciousness in such a way that it mirrors our initiatory procedure. In this way, the more we are investigated, the more masses of people are psychologically processed by the very people who seek to expose us. The meme that constitutes our essential structure is then successfully mimicked within the consciousness of those who investigate us. Success can then be measured precisely to the extent that our work is exposed." When I read that, I thought, yes, that's it. I had never read such a potent description of what is going on. We could certainly spend the hour discussing this one paragraph. Where did you come across this description of what you term the method?
The revelation of the method actually comes from my mentor, James Shelby Downard. I met him in St. Petersburg, Florida in the mid-1970s, and he was a very unusual man. He walked the razor edge between genius and eccentricity, but he had a mind where he was able to see and detect patterns. And also he had a historian's mind in terms of the research that he did. And he was the one that set me on this path of the revelation of the method. He also called it must be, or the making manifest of all that is hidden. And in the sense that in the very last days, not necessarily the last days of the planet or some eschatology like that, but in the last days of this grand conspiracy, which he centered and I center also in Great Britain as a initial starting point for it. And there are many other starting points, but that's perhaps the major one. What was set in motion in terms of what we saw with the first atomic bomb blast, the creation and destruction of primordial matter at the Trinity site on the 33rd degree of north parallel latitude in New Mexico. And then the assassination of Kennedy, the killing of the King Wright in 1963, close to the 33rd degree of north parallel latitude. And then Mr. Downard added to that the revelation of the method, that the way that the system would deal with this is by first suppressing it and then letting its own critics and investigators of the phenomenon be the ones who actually emblazoned and embellished their own invulnerability, as they're very much concerned about projecting a sense that they are virtuoso criminal masterminds, which indeed they are, but they're actually invested in having that set forth because it demoralizes people and it encourages a great deal of the apathy and abulia or lack of will that we're seeing in the people today.
And what do you mean by the term cryptocracy?
That was Walter Bauert came up with that, Operation Mind Control, a seminal book, also from the 1970s, I believe. And the cryptocracy would be rule by secrets. But of course, as they approach this terminal phase, having accomplished so many of their objectives, there's less and less a reliance on keeping secrets. Now, of course, some secrets have to be kept in the short term, but Mr. Downard talked about the cryonic process of freeze and thaw, so that initially there are secrets kept. For example, if you look at the Las Vegas shooting massacre in the fall of 2017, you see the lone nut meme that was put forth there. The U.S. media reported the next day, October 2nd, quote, police believe Paddock act alone in executing the deadliest mass shooting in modern history. Well, I'm a former reporter for the Associated Press, and that rubs my journalistic instincts wrong when I see that less than a day after the atrocity, when a thorough investigation should have just begun, police were establishing the grounds for a lone nut meme that Paddock acted alone and he certainly had no support. Although that was, even though that was implanted in the minds, less than 24 hours later, Las Vegas Sheriff Lombardo shattered it like a broken mirror, saying that he couldn't actually countenance the idea that such a extensive massacre was the work of one man. So that was telescoping the whole process into a much shorter scenario than what we saw with David Berkowitz, for example, who again repeating this pattern where they arrested the so-called Son of Sam killer in 1977 in New York City, declared him to be the lone nut who was responsible immediately after his arrest, again, when the investigation should have begun in earnest. And then later on, Maury Terry and others wrote big books about the extensive connections that David Berkowitz had, and that there was no way he could have done all of those heinous murders, in the same way that Ted Kaczynski, who has been a very willing scapegoat in the process of labeling him a lone nut, and there's no way that he was solely the only Unabomber or university and airline bomber. So we see these patterns, and it's a case of taking them step by step and understanding the ultimate design here, which is the processing of humanity.
You write that, quote, the occult cryptocracy processes the group mind of the masses mainly through psychodrama. What is an example of this psychodrama?
Well, if you're a Roman Catholic who lived long enough, then you know something as the Tridentine Latin Mass, which was derogated in 1969 by Pope Paul VI. Prior to that, it was the main ritual of Catholic worshipers. And in there, you're watching a psychodrama, which I'm not suggesting is malignant, but it is one of the most, Joseph Campbell called it one of the most fantastic ritual enactments in Western civilization. And if you watch it, every gesture of the priest, whether it's his fingers, his hands, his movements, are all orchestrated, and they all have meaning and significance. And so for older Catholics who have been percipients at that from their childhood onward, I think there's a greater understanding and acceptance of what you mean by psychodrama, because what the Church did with the Tridentine Latin Mass was it was able to imprint on the minds of the percipients a tremendous sense of awe and reverence for what was being enacted on that altar, apart from the truth or falsity of the dogma behind it. And by the same token, there is a power in ritual. Now, in terms of pop culture, it's been exaggerated out of all proportion, the so-called Black Mass, which is supposed to be a mirror of the Tridentine Latin Mass. However, there is some sense to that. In the reversal of that Mass and the use of gestures and symbols, which are very carefully orchestrated down to the minutest detail, the minds of people can indeed be processed. And the question I raised in Secret Societies and Psychological Warfare is, what if there is a civic magic by which a kind of open-air ritual, a kind of open-air mass, if you will, is being conducted through these various ceremonial killings that we saw? They've tapered off the kinds of killings like Berkowitz was engaged in and the Hillside Strangler with a tremendous amount of symbolism connected to them. We haven't seen as much of that recently. We've been inundated more with these mass shootings. But nonetheless, that was the question that I asked, and I sought to answer it by looking for parallels in terms of this intricate symbolism, very carefully orchestrated. And one of the purposes of the book is to try and document that in the various cases that I enumerate.
This alchemistry that they practice is what I would describe as mind sorcery or spiritual sorcery. And it's to create a state of needlessly, desolation and chaos and hopelessness in us and to destroy our will. And when they freeze and thaw this thing, like he was talking about just a few minutes ago, maybe this Time article, in other words, the deep state held as much as they could this secret collusion, I should say, of these different very powerful groups that had come together to get rid of Trump. Trump was in their way and was disrupting their plundering operations. And so they came together. Now, why did they come across with this Time magazine article when the Lucis, who had controlled and started Time years ago in New York City, were sin archists? And this synarchy, synarchy, was the concept of controlling a political entity from a mystery school or a secret society group. But anyway, listen to what Ingram has to say about this Look article, and then we'll come back and play just a small clip of Michael Hoffman ending this interview with Bonnie Faulkner, talking a little bit about the Yellow Vest movement in France. But here we go now with Ingram talking about this Time article in Time magazine. But anyway, here we go with this Ingram.
2 months ago, President Trump was roundly ridiculed for making this observation.
For months leading up to the presidential election, we were warned that we should not declare a premature victory. We were told repeatedly that it would take weeks, if not months, to determine the winner, to count the absentee ballots, and to verify the results. My opponent was told to stay away from the election. Don't campaign. We don't need you. We've got it. This election is done. In fact, they were acting like they already knew what the outcome was going to be.
Well, it turns out he was right. This wasn't some paranoid fantasy. There was a very real and vast conspiracy to unseat him, and now it's all laid out as clear as day in the pages of Time magazine. The article written by Nancy Pelosi biographer Molly Ball describes this effort as, quote, a well-funded cabal of powerful people working together behind the scenes to influence perceptions, change rules and laws, steer media coverage, and control the flow of information. They were not rigging the election. They were fortifying it. They believe the public needs to understand the system's fragility in order to ensure that democracy in America endures. Well, as you can see, Ms. Ball, she wants to kind of cast this, these shadowy leftists as heroes of democracy. Well, indeed, one of the umbrella groups involved called itself the Democracy Defense Coalition. Yeah, it's kind of catchy, right? But that's not what they were up to. Now, this wasn't about protecting democracy, but about knocking out Trump using any means necessary. And tonight, we're going to lay out the three major players of this unholy anti-Trump trinity. First, obviously, is big tech. Now, it's no secret, right, that Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg, Twitter's Jack Dorsey are rabid leftists and supported Biden. We know that the mass censorship we saw in the run-up to the election was part of a coordinated effort. It's obvious. But Time reports, in November 2019, Mark Zuckerberg invited 9 civil rights leaders to dinner at his home, where they warned him about the danger of the election-related falsehoods. It took pushing, urging, conversations, brainstorming to get to a place where we ended up with more rigorous rules and enforcement, says Vanita Gupta, president and CEO of the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights, who also met with Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey and others. Now, who is Vanita Gupta? Well, she's now Biden's associate attorney general over at DOJ. Perhaps a reward for her good work on Zuck and Dorsey. Now, these meetings paid huge dividends for the Biden team because in the months before Election Day, social media giants effectively became Joe's Ministry of Truth. Big Tech gleefully censored Trump's tweets and basically erased the New York Post bombshell on the Hunter Biden laptop and all the China connections from the Internet. It was just gone, which, of course, gave the media cover to ignore it as just more Russian disinformation. That alone may have cost Trump the election. A Media Research Center MRC poll from November found that 4.6% of Biden voters would not have voted for him had they been aware of the Hunter Biden scandal. Now, remember, Biden only beat Trump by 4.4% of the vote. Now, of course, we can't leave out the fact that Zuckerberg was key to realizing the left's dream of mass mail-in ballots. He donated $300 million to local election offices and to liberal activists masquerading as nonpartisan voter education efforts. It's a lot of coin. Those leftists then turned around and worked to expand vote by mail and then enroll millions of voters. Well, this brings me to number 2, BLM. When it came to turning out voters at the polls, these Marxist radicals were indispensable. Time magazine noting that the organizers who helped lead BLM wanted to harness its momentum for the election. They created a force of, quote, election defenders during early voting, and on election day, they surrounded lines of voters in urban areas with a joy to the polls effort that turned the act of casting a ballot into a street party. Black organizers also recruited thousands of poll workers to ensure polling places would stay open in their communities. In other words, BLM, they were really loyal Biden foot soldiers. I seem to remember someone saying something about this 6 months ago or so. What you're seeing on the streets, that leftward lurch of the Democrat Party, is their reaction against you. It's not just that they despise Trump. Sure they do. But they despise you, your patriotism, your church going, your Judeo-Christian values. You represent the old America that they want to destroy, root and branch. The third anti-Trump force in this unholy trinity is, of course, big business. Now, back in September, we saw a lot of headlines like this one from CNN. Pro-business Chamber of Commerce is backing 23 vulnerable House Democratic freshmen for re-election. Now, 18 of those Democrats voted in support of a $15 minimum wage, which has long been a goal of big labor and something the chamber supposedly opposes. Well, the chamber's overture to pro-union Dems may have been greasing the skids for what came next. Time reports that about a week before Election Day, AFL-CIO advisor Mike Podhoretzer received an unexpected message. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce wanted to talk, agreeing that their unlikely alliance would be powerful. They began to discuss a joint statement pledging their organization's shared commitment to a fair and peaceful election. Now, the chamber says this alliance was formed out of concern for economic disrupting civil disorder. But is that the real reason, or was this about something else entirely? Like ensuring there'd be access to cheap foreign labor. Endless streams of people coming across the border. Now, Trump kept labor markets tight by clamping down on work visas and securing our border. While that's great for American workers, the Chamber of Commerce hated it. So did their corporate cronies. AFL-CIO likes porous borders. It hurts their members, but they salivate at the prospect of bolstering their ranks and increasing their membership dues. That's all fine and dandy for them. Biden's policies would give them that, and we're already getting a glimpse of what our economic future will look like.
The first jobs report of his administration showed that employers created only 49,000 jobs in the month of January.
This morning showing how bad the jobs market is right now and how slowly recovery is going to be.
Very gloomy outlook for economic recovery here in the United States.
Now, Democrats have control for at least two more years. But the more we learn about how they got there, and the more we see the disastrous results of their policies and this collaboration, the easier it will be to end that control and give it back to those of us who want to empower Americans, not just manipulate them. And that's the angle.
So was it that freeze, and is the Time article an unfreezing of what really happened? It's something to ponder, and it makes us helpless. Like, we can't really do anything about it now. And that's the kind of our will is being destroyed. And that's what this alchemistry of trauma-based programming is attaining. But coming back to Michael Hoffman speaking with Bonnie Faulkner, he speaks just a little over a minute here about the Yellow Vest program in France. And this is really interesting, too. Here we go now.
And I'm specifically concerned about people in the West and not as familiar as, say, as what's going on in China or India or the Middle East. But in the West, why have people deteriorated to the extent that they have? And so, for example, when I see the Yellow Vest movement erupting in France, I have to smile because I don't know every aspect of it. And I certainly don't endorse every aspect of it, but I see that they are willing to, it seemingly, so far, until maybe it's captured, to be somewhat of a little bit of an anti-occult movement. Certainly, Macron is an agent of the money power. You know, I'm not endorsing vandalism or anything like that, but it just seems like there's a little bit of humanity popping up there and saying no to this entire system. And something like that gives me hope. But I think that ultimately the manipulation is at a spiritual, psychological warfare level, and which is the most dangerous, and we need to be vigilant concerning it.
There's another little clip that Owen Schroyer of the War Room seemed to come up with, this danger that is being proposed against the domestic terrorist. And they're trying to label everyone that is a Trump supporter as a domestic terrorist, and then they can go after them or something. And this is where this spiritual warfare is underway. And that's why Michael Hoffman ended up with, the spiritual warfare is underway and it's very dangerous for the world. And Owen Schroyer seemed to say, yeah, they're making very subtle statements, not explicit statements, but statements that point towards going after and purging or doing away with these so-called domestic terrorism terrorists, they're saying. Here we go with Owen Schroyer, and he's opening with some MSNBC a panel discussion. So here we go now.
We had a policy, and it was very controversial. It was carried out under the Bush years and under the Obama years, of attacking terrorism at its root, of going after and killing, and in the case of Amar al-Awlaki, an American, a Yemeni American, with a drone strike for the crime of inciting violence, inciting terrorism. Mitch McConnell was in the Senate then. He was in the Senate after 9/11, too. How does Mitch McConnell, who understands that the way you root out terrorism is to take on, in the case of Islamic terrorism, kill those who incite it, how does he not vote to convict someone that he said on the floor of the Senate incited an insurrection?
So they're now saying you should be killed. And this is just the beginning. All right, ladies and gentlemen, we have a shocking clip here of an MSNBC segment that's gotten hardly any notice, and that's because it was very subtle what the host said, but we pick up on those things here, the little nuances, the little subtleties of their terroristic threats against us. So listen to what was said. Listen carefully to what was said on MSNBC just the other night.
And again, that's not us saying so, John Hyman. That is a bulletin released to all law enforcement earlier this week that there is, until the end of April, a persistent threat of domestic extremism, domestic terrorism carried out in the ideology and around.
No, she's not talking about the riots of 2020 that caused billions of dollars in destruction. No, she's not talking about that from 2020 or 2018 or 2014 or any other of the Democrat riots that they promote in the media and then bail out with their bailout funds. No, she's not talking about that. Just so you're aware, it's only you. If you go out on the streets, she's talking about you, the Trump supporter, being out on the streets. You're considered a domestic terrorist now just for existing. But listen to what she proposes needs to be done to you.
Believe that the election was fraudulent, but the COVID restrictions are unnecessary. All of those ideologies pushed by Donald Trump. But my question for you is around incitement. We had a policy, and it was very controversial. It was carried out under the Bush years and under the Obama years, of attacking terrorism at its root, of going after and killing, and in the case of Amar al-Awlaki, an American, a Yemeni American, with a drone strike for the crime of inciting violence, inciting terrorism. Mitch McConnell was in the Senate then. He was in the Senate after 9/11, too. How does Mitch McConnell, who understands that the way you root out terrorism is to take on, in the case of Islamic terrorism, kill those who incite it, how does he not vote to convict someone that he said on the floor of the Senate incited an insurrection?
So they're now saying you should be killed. And this is just the beginning. You know, here's our biggest problem at InfoWars. And it's a problem, but it's not a problem. It's just the truth. You know that video of Alex Jones where he's confronting Sundar Pichai? You know, you notice something about that video now, don't you? He's the only one that will do it. The one man in the crowd. Everybody knows Google's evil. Everybody knows what they're doing. Now it's even worse with the censorship. But, you know, helping China enslave, round up dissidents and kill them. Yeah, Google does that. Google censors American free speech. Google tries to fix reality with their search algorithms to what you think and see. But you notice how Alex Jones was the only person there that day that dared stand up to Sundar Pichai. Whole room full of people. Alex Jones was the only one. Kind of like when I was in Congress and I stood up to Jerry Cobblepot Nadler. Whole room full of people. Including a lot of my fans who shook my hands that day. Said, members of Congress. I mean, I'm not going to get too much into it, but they saw me. They were like, holy smokes, Owen Schroyer. Like, I was a big deal to them. They were the congressmen. But I was the only one. I was the only one that stood up. And so you've heard us before here on InfoWars talk about how they want to kill us. Think, oh, you can't say that. Here's our problem. We're so far ahead of our time that, you know, there was a joke around here for a while. We were sitting around, a couple of us with Alex, just kind of chopping it up, shooting the you-know-what, shooting the bull. And Alex said something that was kind of funny at the time. It was kind of a running joke for a while. He said, I live in the future. But that's what this is, folks. We really do live in the future. It's like if life is a game of chess and the best chess player can see 30, 40, 50 moves ahead, That's where we're at. Alex knew Google was evil. Alex knew he had to stand up to Sundar Pichai at that moment. Nobody else was in the future except Alex Jones. Owen Schroyer knew that he had to stand up to Jerry Nadler that day. I knew Jerry Nadler was lying and that the whole thing was an insurrection against our duly elected president. But I was the only one in the future that day. And so these events of Alex and myself and Laura Loomer and others, these are going to become commonplace in the next 10 to 20 years. Everybody's going to be standing up, but that's why they're building the barricades at the Capitol, because they don't want to see it. They know America knows the crimes they've committed and is about to rise up and call them out on it, so they're shutting you down.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is getting dangerous out here. This is getting really, really dangerous. So we must stand up for truth. And this thing about going after this group and going after that group, we've got to try to unite back together. Anyway, coming up next is an interview that Max Kaiser had with Alex Jones. Alex interviewed Max Kaiser, and they got into this money question. And Max Kaiser said some very, very interesting things about them trying to remove the dollar as the reserve currency in the world. And there's a recent article out by Zero Hedge that really got into that. We'll have that up on our site, thesecrettruth.com. So look for that at our site. But here we go with Alex Jones interviewing Max Kaiser. Here we go now.
Right. Hey, great to be back. Great to see you. I think a couple of things are very interesting right now. The Wall Street Bets phenomenon of the last week or so is really important, really interesting. It exposed a lot of things definitively that needed to be exposed. And then, of course, the silver squeeze came along, and that is also very interesting. And, of course, Bitcoin continues to dominate the story. But going to Wall Street Bets for a second. So this is a group of Reddit traders that figured out that there was one particular stock that was vulnerable to having a lot of people suddenly buy it and create what's called a short squeeze, because the hedge funds had sold short stock. But what this revealed, Alex, I think, was the existence now, definitively, we can talk about it, of naked short selling. Naked short selling is when hedge funds sell non-existent stock. They counterfeit sell orders. So in the case of GameStop, there was something like 2 times as many shares that existed entirely in the company's stock portfolio was sold on the market. So that was naked. And a lot of people have talked about this and said it doesn't exist. And the reason it's important is that it also dovetails into the silver story. So we've been saying now for years, the reason why silver doesn't really move the way it should is because there's an incentive by banks and Wall Street and central banks to keep the price of silver and gold cheap as possible relative to the dollar. And they do it using naked short sells. They literally sell, in the case of silver, 5 to 10 times annual silver production in one morning. In one morning selling spree, they will sell 10 times annual silver production in these naked short sales or counterfeit sales to just bang the price down.
And by the way, I said 10 years ago, you've been coming on for 15, 16 saying that. Bob Chapman was always hammering that. This is now mainstream. Back when you talked about it, nobody talked about naked short selling of silver to, again, take paper that they didn't take delivery of silver and use that to artificially lower the price, which then allows them to hide inflation, correct?
Well, it allows them to keep the support of the dollar and to keep gold and silver away from people's investment capital, because if gold and silver were to really reflect the number of money that's been printed, and something like 30 or 40% of all the money ever been printed in American history has been done so in the last few years, right? So the money printing is off the charts.
So what would gold be conservatively right now?
Without the market manipulation, gold would right now be in the $2,700 to $2,800 per ounce level to be on the conservative side. That's where it would be without the fake selling. It's around $1,800. So it'd be $1,000 higher. Silver would be already $60, $70 an ounce without this manipulation going on. And so the GameStop in Wall Street Bets very blatantly exposed massive fraud going on with, in this case, Melvin Capital, that's a hedge fund, When Malvern Capital had unrealized losses of a couple of billion dollars, guess who bailed them out? Citadel Capital. Citadel Capital bailed out Malvern Capital with money that they themselves got in a bailout from the federal government last year. Who orchestrated that bailout? Well, it could be one of their board members. Ben Bernanke, former Fed chairman, sits on the board of Citadel Capital, who bailed out Malvern Capital, who covered those exposure to the short squeeze, as it's called, from the Reddit crowd. And now there's a lot of coordination going on with Robinhood and all these other trading apps all working together, which is called it's anti-competitive behavior, which is technically illegal, to clamp down on anybody who threatens the sanctity of these hedge funds. And the hedge funds and the folks who run the major funds like Citadel are, as Eric Holder said back in 2008, Alex, when under the Obama administration, he came up with what's called the Holder Doctrine, which states categorically that banks are above the law, that banks are too big to jail, that they enjoy a special status, they're systemically important to the economy, therefore a national security item. And then
the revolving door goes into that law firm in D.C. where he gets paid himself tens of millions of dollars. They get paid hundreds of millions to then represent those very same banks.
Exactly. So it's a revolving door between the public sector and the private sector. And a banker like Ben Bernanke is a great example. He went from being Fed chairman to sitting on the board of Citadel. We had Janet Yellen, who left being the Fed chairman, who gave speeches to Goldman Sachs and others for, we know, $800,000 she made in speaking fees. And now she's back at Treasury. So she's it's a revolving door. They go back and forth. She should recuse herself from any of these proceedings because she's been compromised, but that's not going to happen either.
All right, Max, we got to go to break. We've got you into the next hour. Really happy to have you here. You're at orangepilldailydose.com, and you're at swanbitcoin.com, also at Orange Pill. You'll tell us about that when we come back. But I just want to ask, million-foot view, 35,000-foot view, one-inch view, just in general, where the world is. I know it was volatile 15 years ago and way overvalued. Now where is it? And all the hyperinflation behavior and all the government's printing crazy and no one is even worried about price-earnings ratios. And it just it has a feeling of Weimar Republic, Zimbabwe to me. But you're really the expert on this, and so I want to get your take on that. And obviously, I should get back into silver and gold. I mean, I already did that in the last 6 months. I've been out of it for 4 or 5 years. But I could smell it, see it coming. But how high is it going to go? And, yes, again, I'm not against Bitcoin, folks. I just get confused by the plethora of offerings. We'll talk about some of that with Max Keiser as well. Tell folks he's on. We'll be right back. And like, the doubling of profits of big tech during the lockdown, I mean, to me, this is that super predatory Wall Street takeover you've been warning of.
Yeah, that's true. Every bank around the world is just printing lots of money, and they do it in a coordinated fashion. And it's about debt monetization, right? They print money, and then they buy it back. They put it back on the balance sheet of the central bank. And they do it really for only one reason, and that is to keep the major banks in these countries from having to officially declare insolvency. All the major banks in the U.S. and the U.K. and Europe are technically insolvent. But to keep the capital structure of those banks alive, the central banks create tons, you know, trillions and trillions of fiat money, and they cycle it through the banks. And the banks are able to continue operating and paying huge bonus money and huge salaries. But meanwhile, outside of the banks, the velocity of money, which is to say how fast the money is going through the economy, is almost at absolute zero. Small businesses are being destroyed. The cost of stuff like education, healthcare, transportation, all the vital services and that are part of the economy, the costs are skyrocketing.
And Max, slow down there. We got time. Explain velocity of money and the fact that while they're giving themselves all this money, none of it's trickling down. Because they did that on purpose, obviously, with the lockdown. So explain what's happening there with money velocity.
Right. So you have an insolvent bank, and they need all the money they can get to keep their capital structure or their bond structure from having to declare insolvency. So the bank prints up lots of money, and they say, "Hey, we're the bank. We need to the central bank. We need to print all this money because to stimulate the economy, to make the economy go faster. And so the way that the machinery of that works is essentially the central bank creates the money and it goes to the banks. Okay, and the banks are in charge of distributing that money, but the banks don't. They keep it because they can't afford to lend it out. Because if they did, they would have to declare insolvency. So the velocity of money is at a standstill. It doesn't go into the economy. And so because the money doesn't get into the economy, you don't have small businesses are not able to grow. So what happens is the government will say, well, small businesses aren't growing. So what we need to do is to stimulate the economy by printing more money. So they print more money and then they give it to the banks to distribute and the banks keep it. And the whole thing is repeated over and over again now for 20 years.
And then Main Street goes bankrupt in the final phase and they finally buy everything up. And that's the final bailout, vertical integration.
It eventually ends up being owned by one or two players. You know, we've called this in the past neo-feudalism, right? So it's like only a few players end up owning 80-90% of the economy, and everyone else is living, you know, like a pauper, living like a serf. And this is what we're seeing more and more of this. You know, a lot of the gains that were made over the past couple of decades, pulling people out of poverty. We've heard that expression many times. Well, now those people are going right back into poverty because the gains were completely artificial due to just an illusion that comes when you have a lot of money printing and it tends to seep out here and there. But now that it's all drying up and the banks are still there gobbling up all that liquidity, we're going into a situation where you have 90% of the wealth is controlled by a few oligarchs, a few folks, and everyone else is really, really scrambling.
So let me ask you this, because I'm not kissing your ass. It's true. You called this on my show 15, 16 years ago that this is where it was going at this certain point. They admit, Klaus Schwab admits, we're using the lockdown to consolidate and vertically integrate. It's for the earth. We're going to lower the carbon footprint, but they fly around in private jets. John Kerry does. That's their excuse for doing this. But clearly they're accelerating their vertical integration and this road to serfdom and this high-tech feudalistic system that you've talked about, and it's moving so quickly. How the hell do they think they'll get away with it? I guess they just think the media will confuse people claiming there's racism and then we'll all fight with each other, and that's the distraction, because this is incredibly predatory.
Right. They think they get away with it, or they get away with it with collusion, right? So all the banks around the world collude. It's anti-competitive. They collude with each other. And now, so here's, I guess, the difference between 2021 and maybe the years leading up to 2021, Alex, would be that all of this money that's being printed by the world reserve currency, the U.S. dollar, and is held by banks all over the world. Well, these banks all over the world are concerned that eventually all this money printing will result in some kind of hyperinflation. So they've been stockpiling gold. And they have been doing some deals with each other, bilateral deals outside of the U.S. dollar. So at some point, maybe probably in 2021, countries like China, Russia, and others will decide that they really don't want to hold dollars anymore because they would prefer to just rely on their gold. And to some extent, I believe we can talk about Bitcoin in this context. And as Christine Lagarde has mentioned, Bitcoin is an escape valve for these countries to escape the U.S. dollar. And so she's laid out, she meant that to kind of be a warning, but what she did was kind of tell everybody how to escape
the
U.S.
dollar. Okay, we got 2 minutes to break. Stay there. I want you to unpack that in the next hour, the next couple segments in detail. But clearly China's coming out with its own digital currency now.
But just to finish that thought briefly, all those dollars end up coming back to the U.S., and then you see the inflationary spike. Then you see prices go double and triple and quadruple.
So once this process hits, once they start phasing out of the dollar, then that's when hyperinflation happens.
Right.
When the dollars
come back. A lot of the dollars over the years shipped overseas. You know, manufacturing went to China. And the world reserve currency is the dollar. But now we're at a phase where we're into a deglobalization phase. All these countries are basically de-dollarizing. And so at some point, probably in 2021, we're going to wake up one day and like $4 or $5 trillion U.S. dollars are going to be sent back to the U.S. And then suddenly our purchasing power will get be demolished. And
so what are you doing? You're in Bitcoin.
Well, there's three ways to protect yourself, Bitcoin, gold, and silver. Now, the problem with gold and silver, as we've been talking about for a number of years, is that the prices are completely in the control of the same people who are doing all the money printing. Having said that, I think that they will do okay in this environment, but nowhere near as good as Bitcoin, because Bitcoin from here, you know, you're talking about a 40x return. You're talking about moves to 400,000, 500,000. Even Citibank has a price prediction for Bitcoin of $600,000 per coin. It's currently at 37,000. So, I mean, that's the fastest horse in the race, as Paul Tudor Jones called it. It's the one thing you can't confiscate. It separates.
Well, stay there. I'll give you this. I was at Bilderberg with you 12 years ago. And you just laid it all out in the future. And you were eating wine and drinking wine and eating a steak, and you're just like, Jones, listen to me. Listen to me. I'm telling you this, and I'm like, eh, whatever. I'm not going to. All right. Max Kaiser's here with us. Hour number three, straight ahead.
Max Kaiser's right on top of a lot of this. He had some very interesting things to say. Coming up next is Tucker Carlson interviewing DeSantis, governor of Florida. They're proposing a new law that'll rein in these high-tech companies and deplatforming conservatives. So it's really an interesting, they're going to be fighting over it in the Florida legislature. But here's a really good interview that Tucker had with Governor DeSantis. Here we go now.
Ron DeSantis is the governor of Florida, the free state, and he's doing what no elected Republican we're aware of nationwide has done. He's proposing a new law that would fine big tech companies for censoring political candidates. Companies that remove a candidate for office would face $100,000 in fines every day until the candidate's access to the tech platform is restored. Additionally, the law would require that big tech companies give advance notice before they ban users. Governor Ron DeSantis joins us tonight to explain this. Governor, thanks so much for coming on. Did we characterize that correctly, what this law would do?
Yeah, and it's more than that. I mean, I think we're going to do three different things. One is protect Floridians' data privacy from big tech, which is a huge issue. As you said, protect big tech from interfering in an election. And that may mean you deplatform a candidate you don't like. Two guesses as to which type of candidate big tech wouldn't like. But it also means doing the algorithms in a way that will suppress stories or accelerate them to benefit a candidate. That's effectively an in-kind contribution. And then the general protections for deplatforming users. And what we're allowing people to do is bring civil suits under the Florida Deceptive and Unfair Trade Practices Statute and Anti-Fraud Statute, and also allowing the state attorney general to do that as well if big tech is not applying their terms of service in a coherent and principled way, which they almost never do. So we think that this is something that Floridians want protection from, and I think it'll end up being a really good first step. I mean, there's always been the question, what do you do about this? I think a lot of us have thought there was something wrong for a long time, but to just sit back and hope it gets better, that clearly wasn't going to work. So we're leading, and I think it'll be good.
Well, no one has done anything. This is the first example of this that we have seen in this country. I know in Eastern Europe it's been tried. Who is opposed to this? We would love to know their names.
Well, stay tuned, Tucker. Is this going to be a big fight in the legislative session? Hopefully we'll be able to get a lot of support. I think most folks do want protections for their privacy and their data. I think most folks want protections from being deplatformed. And it's not just being banned from Twitter or something. As we've seen, these companies can act, they can collude, they can deny you if you're a small business of payment processing, the ability to use email and text. So what, you go to a rally that they don't like or you engage in wrongthink and all of a sudden your flower business is decapitated for a month because they take action. So I think we've gone down a dangerous path on this. This provides protections for individual Floridians, and I think it'll be very positively received, but we're buckled up, Tucker. We know that there's always fights over these things, so stay tuned.
Yeah, I mean, this really does set the standard for the rest of the country. It'll be fascinating to see who comes out of the woodwork to oppose it. Very quickly, if you get this through the legislature in Florida, will it have implications for the rest of the country?
I think it will, because what we found, Tucker, is when Florida leads, then other states start following. So I think you will see other legislatures follow suit. But I also think it's just a situation where we're a very mobile society. I mean, Florida laws may actually have an effect on folks who are visiting here all the time. So I think it's going to be it's going to have an effect one way or another beyond our borders.
Maybe there's a reason people are moving to Florida, just a guess. Governor DeSantis, I appreciate you coming on tonight. Thank you.
Thanks, Tucker.
If that law is passed in Florida, it would have a devastating effect on the high tech, and they'll be fighting tooth and nail down there to stop that thing in the Florida legislature. You can be darn sure about that. But next, Alex's been interviewing Steve Pachinik for several years, and a couple of weeks ago, well, I would say early January, I think it was, he interviewed him, and he said that there was a coup underway and that Trump would be in and everything else, and it didn't happen yet. But he's still saying that, yes, this is going to happen. And so this is the interview that he just had with him. But also, right at the end, I'm going to play a separate clip, but I'll describe it first, of a poem that Steve Pachinik is reciting. And listen to what he says about Lucifer at the end of that poem. But anyway, first, this is the interview that Alex had with Steve Pachinik about him not predicting quite right. Here we go now with this interview.
Coming to you live from the ATX, broadcasting worldwide. I'm not going to try to rehabilitate Dr. Steve Pachinik here on air in some people's eyes, but he did leave the CFR and say 9/11 was an inside job and call the real perpetrators out that were actually involved orchestrating it. I'm not saying radical Islam doesn't exist. And he's done a lot of other good things. Wasn't for the Syrian war, supported Trump, trying to get troops out. But I thought he was buying into the whole Q8chan deal that Trump's invincible, military coup. I didn't even want a military coup. And I saw this as a big setup. And then I thought the Secret Service would be at the Capitol if they knew Trump was planning to go speak there. Then sure as hell, Trump says, I'm going to the Capitol, and the Secret Service opens up the gates and leads me over to lead it. But already 100,000+ had already marched, and a few hundred were already attacking a tiny force of like 30 police that then got pushed out of the way by, we know, operatives that had embedded themselves in every major patriot group and in Antifa. So I was there witnessing that historical false flag. It was kind of a consolation, like a memento to even be hit in the face with some tear gas. I'm not a victim. It was actually kind of enjoyable. But, I mean, this actually was going on. And so I got to hand it to the folks that hijacked this. You know, they really won this round. You really screwed me over. Felt like I was Jeff Bridges in Arlington Road. But luckily, we were able to de-escalate it so it didn't go to the pipe bombs and the killing that some of the Q-tards thought they were supposed to go in and actually zip-tie people and get them out. The reason they've moved from saying, oh, Trump sent people there, is they wanted to move to a planned operation. But now that they know that the FBI is controlling those groups, now they want to back off that as well. They're even trying to back off the impeachment. Now Senator Kaine wants censure instead. And so I appreciate Steve Pachinik coming on having the courage after he was on. Well, let's punch that up. Is this Steve Pachinik's last interview? Because I'll give you the date. I forget the date. There it is. Is this Dr. Steve Pachinik's last appearance on InfoWars? And that was January 13th, 7 days before we were supposedly going to see Joe Biden's head cut off like a chicken up there on the dais in front of the Capitol running around like a chicken. But it didn't happen. So, Steve Pachinik, tell us, was it all a big joke? Are you in with the Q guys? Were you part of the setup? Or were you really believing this was going to happen? We really appreciate you coming on.
Number one, I enjoy coming on the show. Number two, what I do resent is the ad hominem comments coming from your disgusting viewers who think that I lied or in some way gave them false promise. If they want to know who I am, what I am, let them read my book, American Warrior in Crisis. I came on the show again to basically say to you, I will double down on the military coup. And the reason I'm doubling down is that right now it's taking more time, and I don't directly deal with military operatives as I had in the past when I went overseas. So I still have faith in my cyber command. I have faith in my special forces. I have faith in the generals, Flynn's brother was appointed CINCTAC commander and other commanders. So what I'm saying to you right now is what you're seeing happening is exactly what Trump wanted to happen. He's exposing. Now, you got to remember one thing I've said about Trump. He never fails at what he does. And by the way, he has remained silent. Only one individual picked that up repeatedly, and that's Bill Maher of HBO. He hit it right on the head. Why is Trump silent when in his history he has never been silent? And part of the reason is, and I'm going back to Sun Tzu, he understands that in order to take back the power that he has, he never gave it away, he has to expose to the American public. Number one, I said to you the Lincoln Project was the disaster. John Conway was a liar, pathological liar, and his wife was also a pathological liar. And
he did say in that interview, if I remember, on the 13th, that the Lincoln Project was going down. And you know, about 3 days later, 4 days later, it started to.
All right. What was exposed beyond that was the homosexuality of John Weaver and the pedophilia that was rampant in the Lincoln Project involving all kinds of guys named Schmidt, Mitt Romney, Bain Capital, Google. If you look at who was involved in Lincoln Project, you have a whole list of advertisers and supporters, including some of the major Republican Party. Why did Trump do that? He wanted to expose it on that end. Then the second part, he's showing you how corrupt and stupid Biden is. I said to you before, for years, Biden will pick those people who are incompetent and corrupt, and primarily they were Jewish. I have a synagogue going on there with Blanken, with all kinds of people. I've got 11 Jews in there, all of whom I've never met before, some of whom I have a lot of things in common, but they're all incompetent. They're all Route 28, and they are Washington insiders who are corrupt, making their millions through government contracts and the military. What did I say? The first thing Biden would do, he'd go to war. What happened? 2 days ago, within 24 hours of the time Biden went in, we went right back into Syria, and we have one moron from the National Security Council and the State Department, which is run by Blinken and Wendy Sherman. I got a Jew on top there who's never been in the military, and I have
We got a whole hour here. We got like 45 minutes left, but I got to unpack all this. Let's just go back. Let's just go with your scenario. They are doing this anti-racism stand down.
It's not anti-racism.
Let's talk about it. Let's talk about it, because they are trying to purge the military right now. They think there's a military coup. You're saying there's a military coup. What's going on there?
I just said it to you. Listen, Alex. Listen. I'm telling you.
Listen, Trump's going to get inaugurated on the 20th. I'm saying let's unpack that first.
I didn't say he was going to get inaugurated on the 20th. I never said that. I said that he would still be president of the United States. What's going on in Mar-a-Lago? You tell me. We have another White House that's fully staffed down in Palm Beach.
Here's that last part of that poem, Steve Pachinik recited. Here we go next.
And look, he actually goes to coffee shops and reads poetry in his off time. So this guy doesn't just co-author books with Tom Clancy or help found Delta Force. He's reading poetry. And everybody gets really excited when he talks about who it's dedicated to. This is called Impending Chaos by Steve Pachinik. Here's the end of it.
Present and the future. Incapable of accepting all those false narratives, recounted long ago, time and time and time again. Chaos arrives, long forgotten, yet abounding with that infinite vitality to eliminate and disintegrate matter into electronic chaos, penetrating the invisible and the deadly. Silence, the kind of moon for those who go, not die or disappear. Gloria in excelsis, Diabolus. Lucifer will bear the morning star forever and ever.
Lucifer, amen. What is this? So,
thanks for listening. Good night.